The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. This is our, we hope, our last day of oral argument for this term. And we are delighted to welcome with us students from the Pleasant View Mennonite School. Would they stand, please? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. We have students from the Lakeland Union High School. Would they stand, please? We're delighted to welcome you also. You may be seated. And I think that should cover it. Do we have any other students here from the school? Students come to us, and we are delighted to have them. And many come through a program that is called Court with Class. And this is a national award-winning program that's sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students are invited to join us for an oral argument, and if they do, they've gotten copies of the briefs or other materials relating to the case that they'll hear. And at the end of the second oral argument, they will meet with a justice who will talk about the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues raised in the case. Everyone is welcome to attend that session with the justice, and it will be at approximately noon right here in this courtroom. Yes?
I think we have one other very reluctant student here.
If we have a very reluctant student, you may stand. Tell us your name.
Lillian Cheeseman. A law student here, so.
All right. And
are you happy now?
I'm happy now.
And who are you sitting next to?
If we leave the court, I'm Attorney Ben Cheeseman. I'm Lillian's father.
Oh, that's very nice to have you both. Thank you very much for coming. What year are you in? Since we've made a spectacle of you, we'll put you on.
I'm a 1L.
Good. Good. Well, good luck in the upcoming exams. All right. I'll now, is there anyone else who would like to be introduced? All right. If not, this is your big chance. Okay, let me introduce the court to all of you. Starting on my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. You will meet with Justice Bradley at the end of the second case. I am Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Patience Rogensack. With those introductions made, I will call our first case, 2005 AP 948 CR, State v. Bonds. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Bonds as Assistant State Public Defender, Jeremy C. Perry. Mr. Perry.
Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Jeremy Perry, and I represent the petitioner, Jamal Bonds. There are two issues in this case. After a jury trial, the state changed its basis for the repeater allegation. The state abandoned the three misdemeanors that were listed in the complaint and instead introduced and relied upon a felony conviction. The state's proof of that felony consisted of a CCAP printout. I'm not asking the court to change the law. I'm only asking the court to enforce the law with respect to both notice and proof requirements of the repeater statute 973.12. The law is clear on what needs to be alleged and when it needs to be alleged for a repeater enhancer. The statute tells us any applicable prior convictions may be alleged in the complaint indictment, or information or amendments so alleging at any time before or at arraignment and before acceptance of any plea. The statute goes on and even allows the court to grant the DA, upon the DA's motion, reasonable time to investigate possible prior convictions before accepting a plea. Now, what exactly needs to be alleged is defined by this court in State v. Girard. A repeater allegation should identify the repeater offense, the date of conviction for that offense, and the nature of the offense, whether for a felony or a misdemeanor conviction. Recently, in Steins, this court basically asked the question, did the complaint provide the defendant with the information necessary to identify which of his prior convictions would be used to establish his repeater status? The answer in this case for Mr. Bonds is no. He did not know that when it came to the sentencing hearing that the state would be relying on a felony conviction to prove his repeater status.
Counselor, the case law tells us that amendments are often acceptable as long as the defendant isn't prejudiced. Was Mr. Bonds prejudiced by this amendment? And if you say he was, will you tell me how you think so?
I think that there are several aspects of this which resulted in prejudice to Mr. Bonds. While I don't think that under the law in Girard that prejudice needs to be shown for this violation of the statute, I think that he was prejudiced. It very well affected his pretrial analysis of the case. Before he went to trial, he was faced with misdemeanor battery charged as a repeater, which enhanced it to 2 years. In looking at that and deciding, should I go to trial, he can talk about it with his lawyer and say, well, what does the state need to prove? If they prove the battery at trial, I'm facing 9 months. If I don't think that they can prove these misdemeanors, or if I think they'll have trouble with these misdemeanors because of the 5-year time limit or whatever, and I'm going to hold the state to its proof, then I think that I'm facing 9 months. And then he comes after the jury trial, and the state changes its basis, and suddenly it's a felony that's being alleged.
Well, that all of those things are certainly, from prior case law, valid things for him to think about, but would these misdemeanors have caused him any of those problems? So in this particular case, there would have been a difference that you describe.
Well, I think that we can look at the comments that were made at sentencing, and without forgetting that it was the assistant DA here that for some reason changed his reliance. He abandoned the misdemeanors. And looking at what the assistant DA said, it sounded almost like the state was concerned about whether or not they could prove these misdemeanors. And then Mr. Bonds' attorney stated, you know, about how he objected. He thinks that, you know, they were pled incorrectly. I don't think that the state can prove them. I'm paraphrasing, of course. But looking at those things, and then Mr. Bonds' own comments later on saying, you know, this is, they had the wrong date, it's outside of the 5 years, I think that we can see from that he probably did believe that they were not going to be able to prove these misdemeanors. Right or wrong, I think that factored into his analysis.
Okay. Barry, let me ask you. I want to present you with a hypothetical where you have a defendant who is charged with being a repeater, and his history is such that he has 6 different misdemeanors within the 5-year period, but the state only has to allege the 3. So the state attaches to the criminal complaint the 3 alleged convictions that it intends to prove. While the case is pending, one of the 3 is reversed on appeal. So there's only 2 from the complaint. At that point in time, is the state permitted to bring a motion to amend the complaint to add one of the other 3 that are still sitting out there that everybody knows about but have not been alleged in the complaint? Or does the state have to allege all 6 in the original complaint?
Your hypothetical is a lot like State v. Campbell, and that's where there were 3 misdemeanors alleged. The prosecutor was concerned that one was being appealed, and so late in the game alleged a 4th. The Court of Appeals in that case said that that was allowed. I think that that goes against what the statute tells us and what Girard tells us as far as what is required. In terms of the legislature has decided a specific cutoff time for when to allege the the basis for the repeater allegation to get this enhancer. I think that there's a liberty interest at stake in that a defendant is entitled to know at the time he enters his plea on what basis the state is asking to take away that liberty. So in answer to your question, the Court of Appeals in Campbell, I think it's Campbell, said that's okay. Also in that case, they factored in that Mr. Campbell had not yet entered a plea and then entered a no-contest plea following the amendment so that he knew about it before. He didn't have to change his plea. So that factored into their analysis of it. Whereas here, after trial, if you're hypothetical, they've charged Mr. Bonds, let's say, with he has six misdemeanors in 5 years. They've charged him, they've alleged three. Post-trial, suddenly one becomes iffy because they realize it's being appealed. I think then it's definitely too late to amend.
Your point would be that, notwithstanding the fact that he in fact had five prior misdemeanors, the state, because they didn't allege all five of the valid misdemeanors in the original complaint, would be precluded from arguing a repeater allegation or habitual criminality at the time of sentencing.
Yes. I think that the law is clear in that there's a cutoff time for the state to say what they're alleging and on what basis they're prosecuting this defendant.
And where do you get that cutoff time? Would you show me in the statute? I assume it's 973.12 that you're talking about.
Well, it is, and then how it's been interpreted. In Martin Robles, which was in this court in the early 90s, that case discusses the legislative history of 973.12. And they say that, well, learn from that the legislature in 1965 removed the language that allowed the prior convictions to be alleged at any time before execution of a sentence has commenced, after conviction, or after a sentence has already been passed but execution thereof has not been commenced. Martin Robles says that the legislature changed the statute to allow prior convictions to be alleged at any time before or at the arraignment and before the acceptance of any plea, so that they specifically removed the language permitting the state to allege it later. And I think that's where, looking at that history of the statute, that's where we can really learn the cutoff time.
Okay, so we have the cutoff time, and as I think asked by Justice Rogensack, okay, so maybe they were a little late. A count short and a little late or something like that. But so what? We've got cases that allow for some kind of amendments. You know, if the date is off by one calendar date, make a change. If there's a clerical error that doesn't go to the affirmative pleading requirements, you can make a change. What kind of difference does it make here that they missed the deadline?
Well, in some of the examples you listed, for instance, off by one calendar day, this court said, did he still know on what basis, on what prior allegation, what prior conviction the state was relying on? And they said, yeah, there's really no way. They had the correct case number, the correct county, the correct offense, off by a day. It's kind of unreasonable to think that the defendant in that case was, you know, didn't know what they were relying on. Here, it's three misdemeanors versus a felony that hadn't ever been brought into the picture. And it goes to kind of some fundamental issues of fairness here as far as, you know, this is, you know, it's a criminal prosecution. As far as being entitled to know on what basis is the state asking to, you know, elevate this from 9 months in jail to a truth in sentencing case. and knowing on what basis they're asking for that.
Well, Mr. Perry, let's go at this a little differently. Going back to the idea of prejudice, certainly your client knew that there were allegations that he was a habitual criminal. My understanding of what occurred at sentencing was he did not dispute the fact that he had this felony conviction. And his only question was whether or not it was within the 5 years. It was explained to him that the time he had spent in jail told that 5-year period. And my understanding is he didn't dispute the time that he had been in jail either. So it comes back to how was he prejudiced? He's told he's facing habitual criminality sentencing. He doesn't dispute the fact that he's got this felony conviction. He doesn't dispute the fact that he's been in jail for that time period and that that told the 5-year period. What prejudice really is affecting him in this situation?
Well, as I mentioned before to Justice Rogensack, there is the prejudice to him as far as would he have gone to trial knowing that the state could pick and choose any prior convictions?
Well, isn't that really speculation? He did make a decision to go to trial. He was convicted by the jury. So isn't that just speculation that he might or might not have done something?
To a certain amount, I am guessing as far as what he might or might not have done. I don't know inside of Mr. Bonds' mind exactly what factored into his decision to go to trial. However, this is, part of this, in terms of prejudice, if I could answer it a little more broadly than just how it would affect Mr. Bonds, allowing the state to do this would have big consequences for the repeater statute in general. The 93962, which shows how the sentence is enhanced, subsections B and C, if had a defendant in Mr. Bonds' position been charged with a felony, if the priors were misdemeanors that they're alleging, it increases 2 years, by 2 years. If they're a felony that they're alleging is the prior conviction, it increases 4 years. So if the state is allowed in this case to pick and choose and disregard what Gerard has told us as far as the level of specificity that's needed, in the future we have defendants, in particular, whether or not they're even relying on a felony or a misdemeanor, that drastically, very directly affects what actual penalty they're facing.
Well, that certainly would be a showing of prejudice, I think, in those cases where that applies. I want to go back and talk a little bit more about your discussion of Martin Robles and the legislative history of 97312. In answering a question, you suggested that the legislative history, because of a change in the statute, puts a stop on when you can actually amend the pleadings to change the basis for the repeater allegation. And I'm wondering if there isn't any case law that you know of that limits 97312 to cases wherein there had been no initial allegation, rather than as we are here, where there was an initial repeater allegation, but it was amended, the basis for it was amended.
Well, in Martin Robles itself, that was a case where they were not initially charged as a repeater. Shortly after the arraignment or the not guilty plea, right, the state said, in both Martin and Robles, so that case itself is an example.
Now, what I'm talking about is a case where, in fact, they were charged, as you are here, charged, but there was an amendment.
Well, there are a number of cases where amendments have been allowed.
I understand that. Well, I'm not doing a good job of asking my question. I'm trying to focus on your theory that 97312 has a definite cutoff. And I know Martin Robles was a new allegation of repeater status. And what I'm asking you is, has your research turned up any cases where there was, as in this case, an initial allegation, but it was amended And if the answer is yes, what effect does the legislative history have on an amendment, or is it limited only to initial allegations? Are you kind of following what I'm trying to get to?
I think so.
Maybe. Okay.
I'll try to. If I'm way off base, then just cut me off.
No, that's fine.
This Court of Appeals case, Wilkes, comes to mind. I think it's in line with what you're asking me.
Mm-hmm.
And in Wilkes, he was charged as a repeater. And they alleged a felony offense from, I'm guessing a little bit, but let's say 1985. They came to, I think they had a jury trial. I think at sentencing, it came time to prove the repeater enhancer. And the state said, oh, well, let's use this 1986 felony conviction.
Right.
And the court in Wilkes, I think, left it unclear as to whether or not one existed and one didn't. They mentioned that there were possibly both offenses, or maybe they were just wrong, but they were off by, the two dates were off by about 10 months, I think. And in that case, they asked the question, really, that this court asked in Steins, and that is, did the amendment meaningfully change the basis on which the defendant entered his pleas? And in Steins, they said, you know, well, that's basically, did it, you know, the basis on which he entered his pleas, his knowledge of what they had to prove. And in that case, they said, the amendment did meaningfully change it. You can't do it.
Mr. Perry, let me ask you this. In reviewing the Martin Robles case, 162 with second, 883, I note that the majority in that case addressed two fact situations, Martins and Robles. In both situations, the status of being a repeater was not alleged in the criminal complaint prior to any plea.
Right.
And the issue was, well, can you amend it to add repeater after the fact? And the court said no. This case is a little bit different. It is before the court in a different posture. Here you have the allegation of a repeater status. The question is, which misdemeanors or felonies should be alleged in the, in your position is they should have the exact offenses that the state wants to rely on in the actual criminal complaint, correct?
Right.
And the reason I'm asking the question is when I go back and I look at 973.12, 973.12 reads in its second sentence, whenever a person charged with a crime will be a repeater or a persistent repeater under 932.62 if convicted, any applicable prior convictions may be alleged, not shall be alleged. And the gist of my question is it sufficient for purposes of, or at least under the Martin Robles case, that the state has alleged in the criminal complaint that they intend to prove repeater? Is that sufficient, or does this statute require the specific offenses to be established? I'm not sure the statute says that, particularly when you read it in along with 939.62.
Sure. And I think that the statute, using the word may, if left alone without any case law, we would have that question. In Martin Robles, as I mentioned earlier, what goes into the legislative history, where they specifically removed language that permitted them to amend the prior convictions at a later date, Martin Robles then said, you have to do it. That means you have to do it now. May, in this case, I believe, is equivalent to shall.
But Martin Robles said you have to allege that he's a repeater now. I'm not sure it says that you have to allege what specific violations now.
Well, and then we can look to Girard, which is also this court, stating what the minimum needs to be alleged in the charging document. And then further, in Steins, we're saying we're looking at the charging document and what was his knowledge at the time he entered his plea as far as what was the state resting its repeater allegation on.
Why did the state change from misdemeanors to a felony?
In this case, Just in looking at the prosecutor's comments, the best I can tell, I mean, the prosecutor said, quoting him, upon further review, I think it is a little cleaner on the grounds I'm about to propose. Then later he says, but I think that using the felony is a little cleaner and doesn't rely on the older misdemeanors that we need to piece together confinement time. There's the complaint alleged date of conviction of August 20th of 1999. The judgments of conviction that he had attached showed a conviction date of April of 98. Maybe he was concerned about having to piece that together and show to the court what was corrected, what Mr. Bonds had notice of. If I could talk briefly.
Can I just ask you a question here? My understanding is then he ditched the misdemeanors ultimately at sentence.
Yes.
So he only then was relying on the felony.
That's right.
My other question is that do you think that the fact that there's a felony, forgery, would induce a judge to give a heavier sentence than three misdemeanors, which on their face look as if they're no crime is minor, but less serious than a felony, although if one looked behind these misdemeanors, they may have been charged down. So do you think he thought maybe a felony would be more convincing?
Well, I frankly had not thought about that angle. I think that that's reasonable. Felonies are worse than misdemeanors. His prior record would have been known to the sentencing judge, so he would have been apprised. He could have been apprised of that regardless.
Counsel, I want to take you to the second argument if I can. I've got a couple of questions I want to ask about that. If, let's say you lose on the first issue, and we're at sentencing, and the state comes to court and it submits some CCAP records to the court and gives them to the defendant, would you dispute that if the defendant admits that those were indeed his or her violations, that that's sufficient? Would you argue with that?
Well, if there are two ways to prove this. There's either the defendant can make a direct and specific admission to it.
And that's what I'm talking about. If the defendant were to admit,
if that were the case, I think that it wouldn't be an issue.
All right. And if the defendant fails to admit, then the state has to prove, and your contention is the CCAP records are not sufficient, correct?
That is my contention.
Now, let's say you get to the point where the state submits these CCAP records and the defendant fails to admit. Would you then say that the state has failed to meet its burden of proof for purposes of the sentencing and the state and the judge has to go forth with the sentencing, or is it permissible for the judge to adjourn the sentencing proceeding and give the state an opportunity to come in and bring in its proof?
Just so I understand, you're asking if at the time...
We're at sentencing now.
We're at sentencing.
The state comes in, offers its evidence, and the defendant says, well, I don't know if that's mine or not.
I think it'd probably be within the sentencing judge's ability to adjourn the hearing to allow him to call up the clerk 15 minutes to get a certified judgment of conviction.
All right. Now, this gets trickier. I'm very familiar with Milwaukee County practices, and I do know that in Milwaukee County, at least in misdemeanor court, that the only time that even the CCAP record is run is by the charging district attorney for purposes of charging. There's no update that takes place. You've got the judge up there that's got the computer on the bench that can run all the CCAP records and have it right before the court at the time of sentencing. And I believe many of the judges, in fact, do that. The question becomes, it's sentencing. The parties come in. And is it appropriate, since we know that the parties aren't updating the records, is it appropriate for the judge to look on the screen, and if there's some things not brought to the court's attention, ask questions during the sentencing proceeding? Or is that something that should be left to the parties to come in, and it's your obligation, you update your information, and you come and you tell me what it is, and then I'll ask whether there's an admission in it?
I think in terms of proving a repeater enhancer, it should be left to the state. I don't think that in that particular instance that the court should be taking it upon its own to I see that my red light is on.
You may complete the answer.
I don't. In this instance, when the state is saying we want to increase Mr. Bonds' penalty from 9 months to 2 years, and the judge is on the bench and he's got CCAP on his screen, I think that it should be the state that is required to prove, as the statute tells us, the allegations, rather than the court on its own investigation proving them.
So your position is the judge shouldn't even have the computer up on the bench. If the parties bring it in, the judge relies on it. If the parties don't bring it in, too bad, so sad.
Well, I think that CCAP is a wonderful, useful tool that can guide all the parties to where they need to go. But I think that the limitations that everybody has to agree to need to be kept in mind.
What? I know the red light's on.
Justice Wilcox.
Well, just to follow, your argument is that CCAP is too unreliable. Is that correct?
Yes.
And what do you base that on?
Well, in large part, I base that on it telling me that it's unreliable. When I go to the CCAP page, I have to click on something that says, I agree. And what I'm agreeing to is it tells me CCAP provides no warranties ensuring the accuracy of the information contained in the records available. Mm-hmm. And then it says, please indicate that I've read the above and agreed to the use of WCCA subject to the above terms and understand the limitations of the CCAP database. And so if I say yes, I think that it's a stretch then to say this is proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
But that's the point. If it isn't, what I'm driving at is that, it's 2006. This court is going to be making this decision. We have allowed a lot of pleadings to be made, let's say, through the computer. And what you're saying, I would just ask you if wouldn't a proper defense, if it was wrong, you could raise it. But you're saying that now you're putting the state to bring in the original record each and every time, and that's what you'd like us to do.
Well, I think that there should be a degree of formal proof. And in this case, I don't think that the burden should shift to the defendant to have to disprove something or to, if the state brings in the absolute minimum, that's fine as long as, by bringing in the absolute minimum, then it would become the defendant's burden to have to say something in order to get the state to bring in more proof. It's basically, we'll keep telling you until, if we don't complain, then whatever level of proof you want to bring in.
Well, in here, the defendant did not challenge the accuracy of the record. I mean, I'm talking about you are, but at the time.
Well, if I could just briefly, the defense attorney did say, we are asking that the court not only find that the state has not met its burden in terms of proving this beyond a reasonable doubt, but also that they have, in fact, nothing to prove as the complaint, as it alleges the habitual criminality, is defective. So I think that he did object on both grounds.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Aaron R. O'Neill, Assistant Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin, representing the State of Wisconsin. Mr. O'Neill.
May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General Aaron O'Neill, and I represent the State of Wisconsin in this matter. This Court has two issues it must decide in this case, both relating to Wisconsin's habitual criminality penalty enhancer. Those issues involve the defendant's notice of being charged as a habitual criminal and the State's burden of proof in proving the defendant's prior offenses. Specifically, with regard to the notice issue, this Court must determine whether the State was properly allowed to amend at sentencing the basis on which it alleged that Mr. Bonds was a repeater from the three misdemeanors that the State had originally pled in the criminal complaint to a felony forgery conviction. Both the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals concluded that the State's amendment was proper because the original complaint provided Mr. Bonds with notice that he was being charged as a repeater and that the amendment did not cause him any prejudice. The State's position in this case is that those conclusions were correct.
Mr. O'Neill. In the original complaint, there was a repeater allegation that involved three misdemeanors. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Was there something wrong with the way they did it?
There was something wrong in the actual complaint itself. The state did not correctly allege the dates of conviction for the three prior misdemeanors. Instead, the state had alleged the sentencing after revocation dates for Mr. Bonds. But that error was substantially corrected when the state attached the three judgments of convictions for those misdemeanors to the complaint, which provided Mr. Bonds with the correct date of conviction for those three misdemeanors.
They were within the correct time period? The three that were alleged were in the correct time period, even though something was the matter with them?
Yes. The state didn't allege time in the complaint establishing that Mr. Bonds had been incarcerated for a sufficient period of time to bring them within the five-year period, but as the state later proved at sentencing, Mr. Bonds was, in the Milwaukee County Jail for 10 months after the date of his forgery conviction until he committed this battery, and the forgery conviction was entered the day after the three misdemeanors.
If that's the case, why not just proceed with the misdemeanor convictions at the time of sentencing?
I think the reason the state decided to change the basis for the repeater offense was because of this issue that there was this problem with the way the state had alleged the dates of conviction in the complaint, and rather than having to argue this out, just switched to the felony instead.
But didn't they have that same problem with the felony? Wasn't the felony also outside the 5 years? And they had to allege that he was in
prison? I think the problem with the misdemeanors was more of a misstatement of the date of conviction in the complaint, and the defendant was going to argue that the state couldn't prove the convictions as it had alleged them in the complaint, notwithstanding the fact that the state had included the judgments of conviction with the complaint.
Would it be fair to say that the state alleged in the complaint the wrong dates of conviction?
In the complaint itself, yes.
Yeah. And the reason for that is that you had a conviction at one time.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the sentence was probation.
I believe that's correct.
The defendant was given probation, and then that probation was revoked. And then the hammer comes down.
Yes.
All right. And it was the time when the hammer came down that was alleged in the complaint. And that was an error. And that wasn't too long after the Steins case, was it?
I'm sorry.
All of these events occurred when there was a in the Steins case, there was a dispute about dates.
Right. Oh, yeah, the complaint in this case was issued, I believe, after the Steins case, correct.
Okay. So, but that was one day, wasn't it?
Correct.
So the state might have said, well, let's get this nice, clear felony. It's not going to prejudice the defendant. It doesn't add anything more. So let's just do this clean like that. Now, if they hadn't changed it, don't you think the defense would have complained about that?
About the original?
About the error, yeah.
Yeah, I think the defense certainly would have, and I think that's what they were intending on doing, and that's why the state decided to change to the felony. I don't think that argument would have gotten very far, because I think the point of Steins is that you have to give the defendant notice in the complaint of which convictions you're relying on. In Steins, I believe, it misstated the conviction date by one day, but it otherwise identified the case number, the county number, and the type of crime. Here, again, you have the case number, the county name, and the types of crimes that they were, and that they were misdemeanors. And then in addition, even though the conviction date was misstated, the judgments of conviction were attached to it, and the defendant had all the information he needed to basically assess whether he could be proved a repeater on the misdemeanors.
The gap in dates was more than a year, wasn't it?
Correct.
So, you would hope that the state would, when it makes an error, would correct the error.
Yes.
Let's say this case was resolved by way of a plea.
Okay.
and I'm the defendant, and I look at the charging document, and I look at the way that the misdemeanors were alleged with regard to the date of conviction, and I know it's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I enter a plea with the belief that I have at least half a chance of knocking out this repeater because the state got it wrong. Difference between maximum exposure of 9 months and 2 years. It seems to me that if I enter that plea with that belief, that I've got an opportunity to knock this off, and then the state's allowed to say, okay, I'm going to put something else in that's more solid after the plea, that there is a good argument for prejudice against the a good argument of prejudice, that the defendant has been prejudiced because he entered that plea thinking he had something else in play that no longer is in play. Do you agree with me or disagree with me?
I would agree with you under certain circumstances and not the circumstances in this case, because Mr. Bond's belief, if he believed that the state wasn't going to be able to prove up these misdemeanors, was unreasonable given that they were, in fact, could form a valid basis for the repeater.
Well, what's bothered me, though, is twice you said that the defendant was going to argue that the state couldn't prove it. So the defendant did have a apparently strategy that it was going to challenge these dates because they were wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And he was going to argue that the state couldn't prove that they were within the requisite time period.
I think in that case, though, you still have to look to whether the defendant's belief was reasonable in assessing whether he was prejudiced.
Well, didn't the state think that maybe it was reasonable? I mean, why else would the state go to the problem of amending this whole thing and giving us this issue? I mean, if the state hadn't been a little bit nervous, we wouldn't be here today, because if the state hadn't been a little bit nervous, they would have just left it if it was such a slam dunk, wouldn't they?
I think the state just wanted to avoid any dispute over whether it was a problem or not.
Let me just follow up on Justice Prosser and Justice Bradley. The state seems to think that a clerical error in misstating the date by a year, when it has everything else right and has attached a copy of the correct conviction, which probably has a date, right?
Yes.
Okay. That seems to really bother the state that they may lose it. They might lose it. So instead, they totally substitute something else that is totally different. It's a felony, never mentioned before. If they don't think they can correct the first error, which looks clerical, why do they think that bringing in something totally new can fix up the first error? If they think they haven't given a notice, I'm assuming that's where Justice Prosser was going, and if not, I'm going there. Do you know what I'm trying to get at? I mean, here you have, okay, you got three misdemeanor convictions, and there is a mistake in defining one of them,
right?
And the mistake, if you checked everything out carefully, you'd realize the mistake right away, right?
Correct.
Because the correct documents are there.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a, you have correct documents and you have a mistake in a document. So anyone looks at it and you see that the correct document is a copy of a conviction, you might figure that's more right, more correct than somebody transposing it into a complaint. Okay. The state's very nervous because there's a mistake. So what do they do?
instead of correcting that mistake or going along with the mistake and saying, you're not prejudiced by this because under Steins it was one day, here it's a year, but you were put on notice because everything is right except for this one year. Instead of doing that, they drop all that and spring something totally new, totally different, and say, you are not prejudiced because you knew we were going to do repeater. You knew that from the complaint. You're not prejudiced. We can bring in anything. Now that you know we can bring in anything. It doesn't make sense to me.
Well, I don't think the state can bring in anything. I think it would have to be...
fit the statute. I don't have to tell you anything. I can allege repeater. I don't have to tell you which three. Is that good enough?
That's what happened in Fields, a court of appeals decision where the state just alleged a repeater enhancer in the complaint, didn't provide any information about the convictions that it was relying on. And the court of appeals said that, somewhat reluctantly, that it was okay when the state later came back and amended and added the underlying convictions it was seeking the repeater on.
Well, I would be reluctant, too. Don't we have to withdraw language in Steins and Girard? This is on page... 343, 262 was second 343. A repeater allegation should identify the repeater offense, the date of conviction, and the nature of the offense, whether for a felony or misdemeanor conviction, citing Girard, 189 at 515. Then goes on to say the state bears the burden of pleading a repeater allegation with relative clarity and precision, Wilkes, 165 at 111. Don't we have to change that language if we're going to let them substitute anything?
No. Steins doesn't deal with amendments to repeater allegations. Instead...
I understand that, but it does say that the repeater allegation has to do that. And here, you're saying a repeater allegation is good enough and you can fill in the blanks afterwards because you withdrawn the original. Right?
Yes, as long as the defendant's not prejudiced.
So, is it the state's position that if you have a repeater charge, all you have to do is allege that he is a repeater and that later on in the proceeding you will identify the misdemeanors and felonies? Is that enough?
It's enough under Fields, but I don't necessarily know that that's correct.
Does the state think Fields is incorrect? I mean, you represent represent the state and good practice and required practice, right? You think that that's good enough under the statutes?
I think it is.
Let me choke a little.
Well, wait a minute.
Oh,
okay,
I'll let you choke first,
Justice. No,
I'm
not
going to
choke. I think that we all
want to get here.
Hey, this is our last day. Let's all behave.
Well, we are. I think that as long as this happened, that there was a five-year limitation, there was notice, I'm just asking, there was notice to the defendant that there was consideration of a prior, in other words, enhancer. And here, I think Justice Prosser was trying to bring out that there was a mistake, in other words, as far as the dates that the state was trying to correct. Now, certainly this was not a surprise to the defendant that he had been convicted of a prior offense. I mean, that the whole thing about that we're talking about here is the technicalities of how you do something. So the question I have is that you're saying as long as this happened within the 5 years, you feel that it is fair, we're talking about fairness here, to bring that enhancer. Is that your answer?
To change it, you mean?
Right.
Yes, that's my position.
Okay.
Well, as I was choking because I was swallowing my words that I wrote in Stein. That's why I was choking. Because Stein, the court, citing Girard at 515 and 516, indicated what yet you need. And Chief Justice Heffernan wrote Girard back, I think, in 1994, and it was clear that what you need in order to comply with 93962, reading from 515, page of Girard, is that the information will identify the repeater offense, the date of conviction for that offense, and the nature of the offense. And, of course, that's what the Steins court also said, and keeping in mind the state has to allege with clarity and bears the burden of proof. Now, you seem to be saying, and this is why I think what you're saying would require us to get rid of that language in Girard and in Steins, you seem to be suggesting that all you need is to say, given this awful defendant's record, he's got a big record there, just say, he's a repeat offender. Details to follow. I mean, is that all you need to allege in a charging document? He's a repeat offender? And then after the plea or after the trial, come up with the details? Is that what you're suggesting in the Fields case?
I don't think that's the best practice, but
right, that's what you think the law is.
Well, but it's the law according to Fields.
And what do you think the best practice is?
The best practice is to correctly identify the repeated allegations in the charging document and hopefully attach a judgment of conviction to it.
So in your opinion, Fields overruled that portion of Steins and that portion of Girard?
No, I don't think it did. I think that Fields says that even when you don't comply with the statute, the state can still be allowed to fill in the blanks later as long as there's no prejudice to the defendant.
Counselor, I want to shift the focus a little bit before your time runs out here to the second issue.
Sure.
And I had my law clerk copy for me just what shows up on CCAP when you get into it to look at the record. And I guess I agree with opposing counsel. There are an awful lot of disclaimers by CCAP to say, don't rely on these records, essentially. We're not telling you that they're an accurate representation. How do you respond to that argument when you have to prove the convictions beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well, I think that a disclaimer of accuracy on the website, you have to look at the reason why it's there, and I think the state and the court system is probably insulating itself from anyone relying on these records to their detriment. But a disclaimer of accuracy doesn't mean that all the records that are contained in CCAP are inaccurate, and I think that's what...
It doesn't have to be all of them. It only has to be one of them.
Well, that's true, but in that case, if the record's inaccurate, the defendant is in the best position to know at the time that the record is presented to prove his prior conviction that it is inaccurate.
But the standard of proof here is beyond a reasonable doubt. And if the judge is perhaps not enchanted with computers and not as facile as some of our judges are with CCAP, how is he to conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that the CCAP record is proof of this particular conviction? He would have to ignore the disclaimers, wouldn't he?
I don't think so.
Why not?
Again, because even though the accuracy of the records on CCAP is disclaimed in their website, it doesn't mean that all the records are inaccurate.
But what about this one record? You have to prove that this one record is correct beyond a reasonable doubt. And how can you do that when it tells you that some of these records might not be accurate?
I don't have a good answer for that. But
my problem is, as I try to line this up with Saunders, where we looked at a copy of a judgment that wasn't certified, the question there for me was, is the document that submitted this copy of a judgment what it purports to be? You didn't need a certification. The court decided, yeah, it's what it purports to be. But when you look at a CCAP record, what it purports to be in its own voice, for whatever reason, is less than accurate. So I see the questions very differently, and that's kind of what's bothering me on trying to line these two up. And I know you relied a lot on Saunders, and I'd like you to tell me why I shouldn't be concerned about this difference that I'm seeing.
Well, I think if you have to look at the proof the state submits in each case, and I think Saunders pointed out the difference between an uncertified judgment of conviction and a certified judgment of conviction is a stamp, and that record can, I mean, either a certified judgment of conviction or a judgment of conviction can be inaccurate. It all depends on the people who put the information in there.
Well, counsel, if I can follow up on Justice Rogensack's question. CCAP, my recollection is, has many potential errors that are built into it. For example, oftentimes a defendant, when he or she is arrested, to try to avoid responsibility or high bail, may come in with many different names and will often show up on CCAP under four or five different entries. And when you go in and you look under the date of birth and the name of the defendant, you get one series of entry, but you don't get the other four. So there's no coordination there, at least that easily that one can tell. So you have a potential error there. In addition, at least in Milwaukee County, my experience is that they only run the Milwaukee County CCAP records. They don't look at the rest of the state. They don't look at the state internet site to pull up all of the records for CCAP. So that's another potential error area where you don't get all of the records. So when you're looking at CCAP, there are a lot of holes that are there. So I'm having some problems with saying that CCAP by itself is sufficient. Now, opposing counsel has already conceded that, well, yeah, that if we have an admission, that's sufficient, and you would agree with that, correct?
Correct. You wouldn't even need a CCAP record.
My concern is, who should be doing the work, even if you come in with CCAP and the parties agree or disagree that this is the record, whether there's an admission or not, who should be doing the work? Should the court be allowed to have on the bench the computer and look in? And I can think of one example where the parties came in, did their sentencing argument through conclusion, and the poor trial judge is sitting up there and wondering when the parties are going to tell him about the pending homicide in a misdemeanor case that nobody did. There are those concerns. Should the parties be responsible to bring in that information, whether it's CCAP or anything else, or should the judge be allowed to have the computer on, look at the records, and if there's a glaring hole there, that there's three convictions not mentioned, or that there's an error in one of the convictions that's alleged that has since been reversed, should the judge be allowed to ask about that and to get clarification?
I think it's the state's burden to put forth the evidence of the defendant's prior convictions. If the judge is going to try to fill in the gaps, I think you then need an admission from the defendant to establish.
But should the judge be allowed to even ask the questions? Is my concern, because I know the judges have the computer up on the bench, and I know the judges can log into CCAP and will often pull up the records. Is that permissible, or should we require that no, the parties, your job, you bring it in?
It's the state's responsibility.
Counsel, should the state not prevail, what's the remedy here?
It's vacation of the repeater enhancer.
They take that out. Do you need a resentencing?
No.
No resentencing. Just eliminate the repeater.
Yeah, 9 months is the sentence.
Let me ask one other question, Mr. O'Neill. With respect to this particular fact situation, this kind of goes back to the first issue. You had at least four potential bases to prove up a repeater allegation. Why didn't the state just allege all four in the complaint, thereby protecting itself at the time of sentencing in terms of not only meeting its burden of proof, but also providing the court commissioner for purposes of setting bail at the initial appearance with additional information?
I'm not aware why the district attorney did not allege all the four offenses, so I don't feel comfortable answering that question.
Right.
Justice Wilcox?
No, I was just... The facts are that within 5 years, and that part of this is extended because of his time in jail, but within 5 years of the sentencing, there were four matters, as Justice Butler brought up, that could have been used in an enhancer, correct?
one felony. Now, that is what really happened, right? That is what, that's what the facts are. In other words, we know based on, let's say, the CCAP records, that there was one felony and three misdemeanors.
Correct.
And the problem here was that the dates were wrong. So we're all speculating here on why the state should have done this or that. But the, just to ascertain that there were, within 5 years, four offenses.
Correct.
Prior offenses. Okay.
Where is Mr. Barnes now?
I looked on our offender database yesterday, and he was, I believe he's in either the Milwaukee House Correction or Milwaukee Superior Detention Facility. He was taken there at the end of March, and I'm not exactly sure for what. It might be a...
You don't know which sentence of his sentences he's serving out. Is he still serving this one out?
Yes. It expires in July.
So for him, the only thing he would do is be knock off the repeater, change the conviction, but he will have already served his sentence. Is that correct?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, I haven't read the Fields case that you were arguing earlier that I was asking you about, and it seemed to me that you were suggesting that the Fields language would supersede the Steins case, which cited Girard.
I don't think the Fields decision can supersede Steins or Girard.
Yeah, I mean, the Fields was decided by the Court of Appeals before this court decided Stein.
It did.
And so Stein would be, if you will, the last and the higher court.
Correct.
Discussion of the issue.
I have Fields here, and I'm just looking at the headnotes. There, the state's pre-plea submission of a certified copy of the defendant's prior convictions constitute an amendment to the information, thereby curing the information's defect of being insufficient to adequately allege a repeater enhancer and providing defendant with the requisite notice. So that was pre-plea.
It was pre is no contest plea, but the amendment did come after arraignment when he pled not guilty.
It was at the change of plea hearing, though. So
it was before the change of plea hearing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, I mean, 973.12, as I recall it, says it has to be prior to the plea. Right. And Fields was prior to the plea. It was when he was changing his plea, and then it was brought up as that's the way, at least on page 15 of the brief, that you described Fields.
Right. So that's quite a different case than this one. I mean, we don't have an amendment here until after after a jury verdict.
And I think, though, that the interpretation that Mr. Barnes is suggesting, though, is that the information has to be in the charging document before arraignment, not before. After that, it's not permissible, whether it comes at a change of plea hearing or whether it comes at the sentencing hearing or whether it comes sometime in between trial and arraignment.
It could be, but I understood, and can ask him, I guess, but I understood his argument to be based on the very beginning of his argument. He was talking about 973.12 and case law that applied 973.12, and of course 973.12, as he cited and emphasized, at any time before or at arraignment and before acceptance of any plea.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And that has been interpreted in the Martin decision to mean acceptance of any plea, meaning the first plea that a person enters at arraignment.
Mr. O'Neill, I appreciate your concession on the point of who's got the burden of bringing the information to the court for purposes of sentencing. But let me tell you what bothers me about your concession. I'm thinking of an instance, say in an OWI setting, where the penalty is dependent upon the number of prior convictions. And the issuing DA is sitting there and they've got the DA in court has the CCAP record of what the issuing DA had, or maybe they even had the prior convictions from the time of issuance of the complaint. But the person has other pending matters in the state. that are brought to the court's attention. The court is there ready for sentencing. You've got the CCAP records that are available to tell you that, well, there's other stuff out there, and maybe out there to a conclusion, but the parties don't update. They don't tell the court that, yes, there are two subsequent OWIs, which now makes this one a felony, and the trial court, because of the absence of information, sentenced the defendant as a misdemeanant, and thereby an illegal sentence, which means the case is going to have to be brought back from scratch. And I understand, I want to hear this from Mr. Perry as well. I understand that, yes, it's the state's burden to prove. The question is, should the court ignore the technology that it has available and even going out there to ask the questions and putting the state to its burden of proof? Or do you just say, no, it's your job, you do it, you bring me what I need to know, and if you don't, too bad, so sad, you lose, I do an illegal sentence, it comes back later.
I see that I'm out of time. Can I?
Please answer. Yeah.
Well, I think under those circumstances, perhaps the court would be justified in if there's going to be a chance, if there's going to be a legal sentence down the road, the court would be justified. But I think ultimately the court has to put the state to its burden of proving the prior offenses.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Neill. Mr. Perry, you have a few moments in rebuttal.
Mr. Perry, what's wrong with the suggestion that the state has the burden of proof, obviously? This is on the chart. I'm talking about the enhancers. And if the information on CCAP is inaccurate, then simply you would be able, the defendant would bring that to the court's attention. Rather than allowing the defendant to sit back and sandbag and hope there's a mistake and then come up here on appeal and say, oh, you haven't dotted all the I's and crossed the T's, and what we're looking at is not truth. We're looking at just how and what happened. And isn't that what happened here?
Well, I think what's wrong with it is that it's relieving the state of its burden. It's allowing the state to present.
Well, the state said that the burden is beyond a reasonable doubt, and we brought this to the court's attention. And it would seem to me, in looking at the technology that Justice Butler referred to, this is the technology of the day. And I would hope that perhaps not in this case, depending upon how it goes, but certainly there would be an opportunity to use that technology.
Yeah, I'll answer, I think, both questions. I'll try to. The technology is there and should be used. And we shouldn't forget that there are two ways that the repeater enhancer can be proven. One is by a specific and direct admission by the defendant. And
here the defendant didn't know whether he was convicted. Is that correct?
Well, but the prior case law has said this can be cured by one simple question from the bench. And in that case, the CCAP computer on the bench is going to help out a lot. It's going to, you know, if there are any questions, you know, can have a colloquy with the defendant. I think requiring, on the other hand, I think it's a separate issue that when you don't have that specific and direct admission from the defendant and the prosecutor comes in with about the most casual thing he could do to show this prior conviction, and that's printing something off the web. And if you don't have the specific and direct admission, I don't think that by him showing something that lists felony conviction in 1999, that it then becomes the defendant's responsibility to disprove it.
Well, even though it's correct, we're talking about, aren't we talking about truth here? Or just how the game is played?
Well, I think in large part on this, since it is the state's burden of proof, that they need to, if the person doesn't admit, much as like a trial, it's the state's responsibility and their burden of proving it, in that we shouldn't be relieving them of that burden when there's this liberty interest.
You're arguing that that CCAP is not reliable. That's because of the disclaimer.
Yes, I think about it in the sense of, well, what if there was a witness, and the witness started off his testimony by saying, by saying, before I start, I'm just going to tell you I provide no warranty ensuring the accuracy of what I say. And before you ask me any questions, you need to agree that you agree to the terms I just laid out and you understand the limitations of my testimony. And then he testified. I think it would be quite a stretch to then say that that's beyond a reasonable doubt.
Is it a big stretch to have the defendant say that the information is inaccurate?
Pardon me?
In other words, we're talking about a burden of proof here, and you said it was a casual way to do it. And I'm suggesting to you that, based on what I see in the court system, that there are a great many things that the court has been doing, allowing the acknowledgement of the computer. But here, it looks like some of my colleagues and perhaps myself will say, no, that isn't going to be sufficient. But I'm just asking you, if the warranty, or let's say the disclaimer wasn't there, then you would say this may be accurate. But as long as the disclaimer is there, you say that it should not be used in this case.
I would certainly have less of an argument if this warranty wasn't there or if the warranty was the opposite. If it said there are these procedures in place, we know that this is exactly accurate, we have a photocopy that's lifted onto the web of the judgment of conviction, I would have less of an argument. I think that in
Mr. Perry, wouldn't you have a better argument here if the information presented through CCAP was inaccurate? I understand it was accurate information that was presented, not disputed by your client. Am I wrong in that regard?
Well, I don't know that you're wrong in that regard.
So this was accurate information.
I can't say that it wasn't. I don't know, and it wasn't contested. What I am saying, though, is that the source is unreliable.
Chief, if I could.
Mr.
Perry, I just want to make sure I understand one thing here. If the state, in this case, had, instead of charging the three misdemeanors to support the repeater allegation, had they charged all four, the felony and the three misdemeanors, and then came to sentencing and just proved one or the other, in other words, just proved the felony or just proved the three misdemeanors, would that be contrary to anything in Girard, Steins, or Wilkes?
I don't think so. I think that they would have stated the basis on what they're relying on, and Mr. Bonds would not have an argument to say, I did not know that they were relying on this felony or these three misdemeanors.
Thank you.
Do you know how things get on CCAP?
I think from my knowledge of it, and it's limited, is...
Are you warranting this?
Before I answer this question, yeah. I think that it differs county to county, for one, and I think that that depends on the clerk's staff and who is entering this information. But it is data entry, and I don't know exactly how it gets on.
It is data entry, and the result of data entry is there can be an error by the person who puts in the data, right?
Absolutely.
And if there's a misspelling of a name or letters are transposed or date of birth is transposed, the machine is accurate enough that it will just do exactly what it's told. Although occasionally it seems to me the machines go haywire too, but that's how it gets it. Compare that to duplicating a judgment of conviction.
Well, there are some real differences in what has been allowed and what CCAP provides. A judgment of conviction, certified or uncertified, has a signature on it. We know who prepared it. We know who signed off on it.
When you duplicate it, unless the margins are no longer in the picture, which can happen, if you're going to alter that document in duplication, you have to deliberately do it. Write out something, right?
Right.
Add something. Somehow doctor it.
Otherwise it would be the same as the original.
Otherwise it's going to be an exact duplicate. That's not true in a computer where you have data entry.
Absolutely, and I think that that's what we're required to agree to when we look at it.
And understand that. That's why you have a disclaimer.
Right.
Counsel, but in this case, we know, and you know, without being disingenuous, that you know that this was accurate information, and I'm just asking whether or not the court could say that you could use the information and it would be considered accurate unless the defendant brought it to the court's attention.
You're asking me if I think that's what the rule should be? That,
well, you said you didn't think the rule should be that, but I'm just saying here we know that this was accurate information.
Well, with what is in the record, we don't know that. What's in the record are that the CCAP entries were submitted and that Mr. Bonds did not disprove them. I don't mean to try to dance around any question, but really focusing on what was presented at the sentencing hearing, it was just the CCAP documents.
You're relying on the burden of persuasion being on the state, and your client didn't have to do anything. You say the state failed the burden because of the nature of the evidence.
Yes.
Is that your summary of your good
I think
enough?
That's a fair summary.
Okay. That's the end of the case, too. Thank you, Mr. Perry, and thank you, Mr. O'Neill, for discussing a very interesting issue, one that has come to the court in various ways over the last several years. That concludes the hearing in 2005, AP 948 CR, State versus Bonds. The court will take a few moments in recess so that those students who wish to leave may and additional students may enter the court. We are in recess.